Hey there, everybody, and welcome into this Sunday edition of ESPN FC. I'm Sebastian Salazar. Happy Mother's Day. Hope you've enjoyed the weekend so far. We got a full show for you here today, including some explosive comments from Giorgio Chiellini in his autobiography. We'll get the guy's reaction to that, plus some transfer talk that could shift the balance of power in Europe. But we begin, as always, with the latest on how the coronavirus is affecting world football, and we begin in Germany. Dynamo Dresden of Bundesliga 2 has three confirmed cases of COVID-19, that with the league scheduled to return to action on May 16th. Meanwhile, in France, Lyon's president publicized August 7th as the date for his club's Champions League second leg match against Juventus. The club has since said no date has been finalized. And in Italy, La Repubblica is reporting at least six Serie A clubs have not paid their players a wage since January. For more on this, we welcome in the stars of the Gab and Jules podcast, Gab Marcotti and Julian Laurent. Gab, I'll start with you. The news out of Dresden, how do you think it could impact the Bundesliga's plans to start next weekend?
So I think this is going to be the crux of the issue for everybody that restarts, and it's good to be clear here. The key issue that every league is dealing with that wants to restart is, what do you do with a player who tests positive? Do you simply isolate the player, or do you isolate the entire team that he's been working with? What's happened in Germany is this. The German government, they were happy with a protocol that said, look, if somebody tests positive, we're simply going to go and isolate the individual. That's what happened at Cologne and in other clubs where people have tested positive. However, Germany is a federal state. There are 16 states within Germany. And within those states, on matters of health, it's the local health ministry that effectively has control. And in Dresden, the local health minister there said, well, I don't really care what the national government guidelines are. We're going to exercise caution here, and we're going to order the entire team to quarantine. So obviously, they're going to miss 2 weeks. Maybe they can make it up. Maybe they won't. Certainly, their game against Hanover looks to be postponed. This could be a problem further on. It depends what the health ministers in a majority of German regions end up decreeing. My understanding is the majority of them will not be quite as hard line, and the majority of them will back the government and the Bundesliga's proposal to simply go and isolate the individual players.
Jules, what can you tell us about what's going on in France? Busy week for the Lyon president, not just the premature announcement, but he's also threatening legal action against Ligue 1.
Yes, that's right, which we knew since the decision was taken to stop the season with Lyon being seventh and missing out on Europe. And Jean-Michel Aulas has been very vocal in his lobbying in private as well, very active to try to get that decision overturned. And he's still hoping that somehow between now and May the 25th, when really you need to make a final decision on what you do and inform UEFA and FIFA, he's really hoping that the decision could be overturned. He's hoping that he can convince people in France that they made that decision too quickly, too much in a rush, that maybe they could have waited another week or two to see what others were doing in Europe and also what the situation with the pandemic was doing in France, and then maybe take the decision, and maybe that decision would have been different then. Maybe we could have played a few more matches somewhere in August or maybe towards the end of July. So he's still hoping that he can do that. So far, he doesn't have many support with him. There's Amiens and Toulouse, the two teams who were relegated, who are also pushing for that. But three clubs is not really that many to get that kind of decision overturned. However, he still has a bit of time and a lot of faith that he can do that, whether that goes through legal battle or not.
Jules, what do you think about the case that he's trying to make? Do you think there is some regret in France, if not about the decision that was taken, about the timing of it?
I think it's growing a little bit. And when you see other countries, although, as we've been saying many times on the show, the pandemic was fought in a very different way in every country. It hit countries in a different way. Of course, Germany, for example, have, 7,000 deaths. It's far more in the UK with almost 32,000. It's more in France with almost 25,000. So you can't compare really, but however, you can still look at what other people are doing. And I think maybe that decision was taken a bit early when you think that horse racing, for example, is allowed to start again tomorrow in France, but not football. behind closed door horse racing as well. And you think like, well, if horse racing can go behind closed door, surely there might have been a way a month down the line to have football starting again. So there's those voices more and more coming out and saying, maybe we rushed that one a bit more. And I don't know if it'd be enough to overturn it and maybe change it, but certainly you could feel the frustration growing a bit.
Meanwhile, Gab, what's going on in Italy? They're trying to get back to football, but some clubs aren't paying their players.
Yeah, this is a report in an Italian paper saying that six clubs haven't paid their players since January. The initial reaction has been that actually that's more of a technical thing in the sense that they've received their January wages. They did not receive their March wages or their February wages, and that was because the league was halted by then, and they will be getting them later. I don't think that, you know, this is necessarily at the top of everybody's minds right now. Top of everybody's minds is figuring out how to, or if it's going to be possible to get back. This coming week should be a key week. And again, the single biggest issue right now, not the only issue, but the single biggest issue is whether to adopt the going back to what we said about the Bundesliga, the protocol where if somebody tests positive, they simply get go into quarantine, or whether you have to quarantine the entire team. Quarantining the entire team would make it very, very difficult for the league to restart. But it's more meetings this week. There's also the fact that the broadcasters haven't paid their sixth and final installment as well. So that opens up another front, another battle to deal with. That's about 230 million euros, around $250 million. That's up in the air there. So there's a ton on everybody's plate right now.
All right, thank you, Gab. Don't go far. We'll bring you back for some transfer talk. Ian Dark joins us now for the latest from the Premier League, where three Brighton players have tested positive for COVID-19. There's another project restart meeting set for Monday, plus reports of a mini transfer window, which is being discussed for out-of-contract players. Ian, great to have you with us. What do you expect to come out of this meeting, another big meeting on Monday?
Well, I think the conversations at that meeting tomorrow have been made more awkward by what's happened at Brighton, one of the clubs who are, by the way, who are vehemently opposed to staging the games on neutral grounds. But, of course, that's got nothing to do with the three players who've tested positive. It's impossible to believe there won't be other clubs where this happens. So I think the main thing really is safety. I think the players have to be absolutely as sure as they can be that it's going to be safe to play. And I don't think public opinion yet is fully on the side of this project restart. So that's an issue. The other issue, of course, is the neutral grounds issue. I think that's becoming pretty much set in stone, though Aston Villa, Brighton and Watford are very much opposed to it. They think it damages the integrity. But the police say they can't possibly man the 20 stadiums, so there can't be home and away as normal. So I think it will be neutral grounds. And I still think it's on course to actually happen, but there are a few hoops to jump through in this meeting tomorrow. I don't think it'll decide it. I think that might come a bit later in the week.
Jules, transfers are one of the many things complicated by what's going on right now. What can you tell us about this new mini transfer window for the out-of-contract players?
Well, that's a new idea that the Premier League has had to try to resolve the issue of that deadline of June the 30th when the contract will finish. So whoever is either out of contract at the end of this season, it will be done on June the 30th. Every loan players, and there's a lot of players on loan currently in every big league, or small league even, including the Premier League, all those players will be supposedly have to return to their parent club after June the 30th. So if the season continues and there's no agreement, those players won't be able to play with the team that they're currently on loan for, which is crazy. I mean, I cannot believe that this is not one of the issues that has been sorted earlier on. We see with Germany, for example, for them, the way to resolve it as long as we finish the season by June the 30th, we won't have that issue. We won't have that problem. For every other league that will start a bit later, like potentially the Premier League on June the 12th or June the 8th or whenever in June, they won't have finished their league on June the 30th. So you have to find a decision, something for those players out of contract or when the loan finish on June the 30th. Otherwise, it's going to be a complete mess. It's crazy that they haven't even properly discussed this issue.
All right, guys, I hate to do this to you. And Ian, I guess I'll start with you here. Neither of you sounds very optimistic based on what I'm hearing right now. Ian, how close do you think we are to getting an announcement about a restart date from the Premier League?
It could happen, I think, as early as this Thursday. I don't think it'll happen tomorrow. But as I've said, I think there are a lot of obstacles still in the way. And yet, as yet, there haven't been proper discussions with the players. We've had quotes from various players, like Sergio Aguero, who's oft quoted about the players being scared to come back, and one or two have reservations. But I think the vast silent majority, really, I wouldn't say they're simple souls footballers, but they want to play. And I think if people tell them that it's going to be as safe as it can be, they'll be going along with it. So I still think they're on course for it to happen on June the 12th, but it's by no means a certainty.
Jules, what do you think?
I've said it for a few weeks now. I think there will be football, that the Premier League will restart, but not before July. I think mid-June is too early. There's so many things still to sort out. There's no protocol. There's not even a protocol. There's nothing. In Germany, you've got documents and documents, same in Italy, same in Spain, where everything is, the regulation is already sorted. They put everything on paper, what players will do, what people who are those games behind closed doors will do. There's nothing like that in the Premier League. The Premier League is way behind every other league that is thinking or planning to restart and to resume. So I think they will get it, and the government will give a green light, and it will happen. But it can't happen in June. It's far too early. And like Ian said, and I think he's spot on, the players haven't been even asked by their own club, what do you want to do? Do you want to play? Do you think it's safe enough to play, to go back training together, to go back playing in June? What do you feel about that? Are you scared for your family? Are you scared for yourself? Is your wife expecting a baby? Are you even more scared because there's a baby coming soon and you don't want to run the risk of getting the virus and then passing on to your wife and etc.? And those players, they haven't been asked that. Any questions like that, they don't know. And let's not forget as well that some of the Premier League club's doctors wrote to the Premier League as soon as last week, with a lot of questions that they didn't have any answers for. So I think there's still too much to sort out and to resolve for the Premier League to be able to resume at the beginning of June or even mid-June.
Well said, gentlemen. If you want more from Ian, and who doesn't, just go over to our website. Ian has an article over there right now ranking his top 10 signings of the season so far. Plus, Ian, don't go far. You're back for us with extra time and Shaka Hislop.
GEICO has the insurance industry leading app that lets you manage your policy anytime, anywhere, which means that GEICO is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like animal control, when you're cornered in your garage by an angry possum.
Hi, me again. You guys said you would be here about an hour ago, and I think the possum is starting to get angry. Listen, I thought if I fed it, it would go away, but now it is ripping holes in the drywall and making some sort of nest. Just call me back.
GEICO, always there for you with savings and the industry-leading mobile app.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Giorgio Chiellini has written an autobiography, and it is not short on controversies. It goes after a couple former teammates in Mario Balotelli and Felipe Melo. Here's what he had to say about the book in a recent interview. Quote, Balotelli is a negative person with no respect for the group. During the Confederations Cup against Brazil in 2013, he didn't lend a helping hand for anything. He really did deserve a slap. However, there was someone worse, Felipe Melo. Really, the worst of the worst. For more on this, we bring back Gab Marcotti. We welcome into the show Craig Burley. Gab, what's the response been in Italy to what Chiellini's had to say?
Well, we've had the response from Balotelli and Felipe Melo. We've had the two of them come back at him. Neither one best pleased. I think the Balotelli stuff is to do with 2013 and also, of course, 2014 World Cup, where, you know, there was a lot of fallout in the squad. Felipe Melo basically came out and said, well, you know, look, Chiellini's soft, essentially, he's a big baby. And I think I'm kind of surprised that Chiellini would come out with something like this, because, you know, everybody talks about, oh, look, you know, he's this great old defender and he's so wise and he's so intelligent. Well, fact of the matter is, Chiellini is an Italian international. He hasn't retired from the game yet. Balotelli may or may not be back in the Italy squad. To go and have a pop at him like this just seems, frankly, entirely gratuitous. It's just like going after Felipe Melo. At least maybe, you know, wait until you're out of the game before you start with this kind of business. Also, going and targeting two guys who, you know, frankly, very few people seem to like and have targeted in the past doesn't really take a big man.
Craig, what do you make not just what of Chiellini says, but also the timing of it to release this before he's done with his playing days?
Yeah, it does seem a bit strange, but off the top of my head, I can't remember many, if any, who have done it. There may be some. As you're probably unsurprisingly, that I don't pay much attention to football books because I don't read them, anything about footballers. But that being said, I don't really have a massive issue because you make your bed and you lie on it. And so clearly, if a player, current player, writes a book and you're a teammate or a potential teammate, or have been a teammate, then the first thing you're going to ask is, what does he say about me? And if he's been negative about an individual, then you're going to make a decision on how you respond to it. The two players that have been mentioned have responded in kind somewhat at the moment. But that's ultimately what it comes down to, whether you've been mentioned in the book or not. Look, it is a little bit, you know, surprising that he does it now, but at the end of the day, as I say, he's made his bed. And he'll have to line that with the decisions he's made to put in the book.
Craig, in the book, Chiellini says that he went to management about Felipe Melo. How do you feel about a player going to management about another player? Is that crossing the line?
Well, I would like to think that they have had words previous to any player going to management to try and sort whatever the problem was before you take that next step. Look, there are always bad apples in dressing rooms, and you know, senior players usually have to try and weed them out and help them and straighten them out. And if that doesn't happen, management has to do something about it, and it can cause a problem. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, Chiellini's doing what he's doing. Is it ideal? No. But ultimately, as I keep going back to this point, he's written a book. What can't speak can't lie, and he's going to have to he's going to have to take the criticism that comes his way because of that. That's the bottom line.
Gab, you mentioned the response from Balotelli. I'll read it to you here. Quote, "At least I have the honesty and courage to say things to people's faces. You had so many opportunities to do that since 2013, to behave like a real man, but you didn't do it. Who knows what you'll say one day about your current teammates, you strange captain. If this means being a champion, then I prefer not to be one. And I never showed a lack of respect towards the Azzurri jersey." Gab, what are the odds that Chiellini ends up being the bad guy in all this?
I mean, look, the fact with Chiellini is that because he's obviously an intelligent guy, he's one of those footballers the media absolutely loves because, you know, he speaks in complete sentences and he has a university degree. But I just think this is really irresponsible. I mean, look, Balotelli's, everybody knows what he's done in his career. Everybody knows the issues that he's had. Everybody knows about the meltdown at 2014 within the squad. And unless you were a part of it, you're not going to know exactly who was to blame. I mean, clearly, Chiellini wasn't the one who got the blame. Balotelli did. But that said, there's a lot of opportunities where you can go and deal with this. And there's one other factor in this, too. Chiellini wears a million different hats. He also happens to be on the national board of the Italian Players Union. Balotelli, I presume, is a member of the union. He's got a representative role as well. Now, if you don't want to have a representative role, if you just want to be, you know, the guy who sits in the corner and doesn't take official roles and just, you know, speaks his mind all the time, hey, that's fine. But you can't have both roles. You can't be on the board of a union that's supposed to look out for players, all players, including Balotelli, and then go and decide, I'm going to make a few bucks by going and ripping this guy who gets ripped all the time anyway, like Felipe Melo, I might add, and do it in a book. And at the same time, I'm going to be, you know, the guy sticking up for footballers, all footballers, because I sit on the union. I don't think he's thought this through, and I don't think... I know a lot of people disagree with me, but I don't think Chiellini comes out of this looking very sharp at all.
Craig, as a teammate, would you trust Chiellini after this book has come out?
Look, I've had many teammates that may or may not write a book. Some may have. It's part and parcel. You know, just because he's done it now doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to go and write a Watson Hall book, 5 years down the line. So, yeah, it is what it is. You know, if I go to bed at night worrying about all the guys that I played with, whether they'll write a book or not, and whether I'll be in that book, and whether it'll be positive or negative, you know, I might as well not get out of bed in the morning. So, you know, as I say, he's made his bed. He can lie on it. It doesn't seem like an ideal scenario for me from a current player. But what do we want him to do? If he's writing a book, he's writing it. Do we want him to write a boring book? If he's decided to do it, do we want him to tell the stories or not? That's the bottom line here. I really, as I say, unless you're an individual that's involved in Chiellini's book, I really wouldn't be batting an eyelid at it.
Thanks, guys. Great stuff. If you want more from Gab, make sure to check out this week's edition of the Gab and Jules podcast. Drops every Monday over on the website. ESPN FC back on your TV screens tomorrow. Dan Thomas in the host chair on Monday. A reminder, ESPN FC now available 6 days a week. Gab, Craig, we've got some transfer rumors to get through. Let's start with Paul Pogba. Gab, reports out of Italy that Juventus is basically the only team left interested in Pogba. What do you make of it?
I mean, what I make of it is we got to fill pages. You know what? I don't. Juventus have issues. I think midfield is probably not one of them. What they were talking about is some complicated thing where Pjanic goes to Barcelona and then Pogba comes in. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I think everything is on hold until they get a clear picture of finances. And I stick to what Jules always says. You know, Pogba is happy at United. He'd be happier at a United team that was competing for the title. But the way his wages are right now, I don't see Juventus making this work unless Cristiano retires or something, which obviously would be bad for other reasons.
Gab, speaking of Manchester United, the reports out of England are now that they've dropped out of the sweepstakes for Koulibaly, leaving only Liverpool. You believe that?
By the way, I should clarify that bit about Cristiano Ronaldo retiring. It's purely hypothetical. There's no suggestion he will anytime soon. I think like Koulibaly has a clause. He's for sale. The transfer window doesn't open for a while. I don't see why United would make a decision now. Obviously, Liverpool have been strongly linked to him, but I think there's a million twists and turns that this story could yet take. I think it's highly unlikely Koulibaly will be at Napoli next season. And obviously, Liverpool, like other clubs, have taken a long, hard look at him.
Craig, on the show last week, your mate Don Hutchison said, quote, wrap the title up right there if Liverpool get Koulibaly. You agree?
Not quite as simple as that, no, because other clubs will hopefully do business once this pandemic is over. And as Gab said, there's a clearer picture of the financial situation. Look, is Koulibaly, and I said last week myself, is he a great get for most clubs? Absolutely fantastic centre-half. But you've got to weigh up the pros and the cons. He's going to be 29 this summer, in a month or so. There's the financial situation in terms of getting the player in and the wages. And Liverpool have already got, you know, it's not like, you know, Man United's need is more. They've got a good centre-half in Maguire, and then they've got a couple of other centre-halves that I'm sure they would like to get rid of, and if they could bring a player in, they would. You know, Liverpool have Matip, they have Lovren, and they have Joe Gomez, who's an excellent young player. None of them to the standard of Koulibaly, but they've already got arguably the world's greatest defender in Virgil van Dijk. So their need for another centre-half is not desperation. So they've got other places in the team they would need to look. And I would be surprised if Liverpool went out and shelled big money on another centre-half when they could spend that money on other places in the team for the reasons that I explained.
All right, gentlemen, we'll leave it there for today. A reminder, for plenty more transfer talk, head over to our website.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Napa know-how.
Get all the quality parts you need at your locally owned Napa. Because right now, when you order from Napa online, you can pick up curbside at your local store in just 30 minutes. Or get your order delivered direct to your door with free one-day shipping on over 160,000 quality parts when you spend $50 or more. Quality parts delivered quickly and safely. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating stores, standard ground shipping and exclusions apply.
Julie Foudy and Jeff Carlisle join the show. Guys, the U.S. women's national team will appeal a judge's recent decision in their equal pay lawsuit, a decision that went almost entirely the way of U.S. soccer. Julie, let's start with you. We knew that an appeal was coming. I wonder from here, what's the end game for the players?
I still think, even though they did appeal, I still think the end game is getting to the table. And I think both are starting to realize that. U.S. soccer has always realized that, and have been wanting to get to the table with no success, because they realized they were in a no-win situation. Even though they won, and I put that in air quotes, largely the compensation piece of this trial, right? They realize they've lost in public sentiment. And some of the sponsors, of course, have voiced their disapproval of the way they've handled this. And they know they have to make amends here. And so the women, on the other hand, the players, they realize this could be a two-year process. It could be a bargaining chit that they hold in their pocket to get to the table, that they drop the appeal. But I think a two-year process that you don't know the outcome again if you stay with the appeal is something that doesn't favor the future of the women. I think they should get to the table.
Jeff, I'm interested in the Federation's perspective here. Despite the legal victory, it does seem like there's still an awful long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as Julie mentioned, I think there's huge incentive for the Federation to want to kickstart negotiations. Yeah, I think they've been at that place for months and months. I mean, you remember the March 7th letter from then-President Carlos Cordero, where, you know, he expressed the Federation's desire to get back to the table, and he extended some terms that the women were wanting in terms of having the same bonuses, you know, for games that the USSF controlled. So again, I think that's a huge motivation for the Federation. Obviously, they've been bloodied by this, just in as Julie mentioned, in the way that they've carried this out. Granted, a lot of it is of its own making, but especially with almost a completely new leadership structure in place for the Federation, both in terms of the president, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, and the new CEO, Will Wilson. I think there is a revived movement to want to get to the negotiating table and put this behind them. And the other thing that's kind of hanging over all of this a little bit is the CBA that both sides are currently operating under ends or expires at the end of 2021. So, you know, I think the sooner that they can get, you know, a settlement worked out, the easier that it will be to start those negotiations. But I think that will also be an incentive for both sides to try to come to the table and get something done.
Guys, something else that will impact the U.S. women's national team. Alex Morgan had a baby this past week. That's right. Happy Mother's Day to Alex Morgan. Her husband, Servando Carrasco, obviously plenty of reason to celebrate as well. Julie, it seems like kind of an outlier now to see a player in their prime have a baby. Do you think, though, what we're seeing from Alex Morgan may be the beginning of a trend in women's soccer?
Well, for women's soccer players, I think they've proven that you can have a baby and get back pretty quickly. I mean, we've seen it from, you know, going back to my days, Joy Fawcett and Carla Overbeck being the OGs of this, and the originals who were moms and able to combine and balance two great careers and being a mom as well. So Christy Rampone, Amy Rodriguez, I mean, Jessica McDonald, who's still playing right now. So I think, yeah, they realize, and I think Alex is trying to point out that both are possible. I think the timeline that Alex put herself under, had the Olympics actually happened on time in 2020, would have been a really tight turnaround. She would have had to prove that she could make the team in about a month. I think the delay of the Olympics obviously helps that timeline a ton. But yeah, I think she will prove to a lot of females out there who are wondering if they could do both that absolutely you can do this.
When she does come back, Julie, she'll have to fight through a lot of talented players for that top striker spot. Who do you think is her number one competition when Morgan gets back on the field?
I think you have to talk about Carly Lloyd and what she's been doing from that number nine target position under Vlatko Andonovski ever since Jill Ellis stepped away from the job and Vlatko Andonovski came in. He has, and in large part because Alex Morgan has been pregnant, he has put her in that starting position in the number nine, and she's been doing well. 5 goals, 4 assists, and the 8 games she's played under him. But the thing he likes most about Carly Lloyd is not just the offensive production, is what she does defensively and how hard she works. And Sebi, you and I have talked to him at length about this. He gushes, Vlatko does, about the amount of work that Carly does on the defensive side of the ball as well. But I see this actually as more of a tag team. I mean, what a great option to have Carly Lloyd, who will be 39 if the Olympics are to happen in 2021, and Alex Morgan, who's had a year to come back from her pregnancy, available as a tag team for that position. And I think that's where he's going to go. I think you're going to see a lot of rotation in the next year and a half with Vlatko Andonovski and an aging U.S. women's national team.
All right, let's change topics real quick. Jeff, when it comes to what MLS might do with their schedule, I've heard about a million different terms. I've heard studio games. I've heard regional. I've heard tournament. What do you make of all that we're hearing out of MLS headquarters?
Well, I think they're just trying to figure out a way forward in terms of getting the league started again. The latest I'm hearing, and there have been reports, saying the same thing, is that they are looking at kind of a mini tournament, if you will, to be held in possibly one city like Orlando, or maybe they have pods, as I've heard it referred to, where they have a group of teams in, say, 4 cities. They would have a mini tournament with, say, 5 or 6 teams, maybe 7 teams in a group, and each team would play each other once, and then you'd have a knockout stage. So, it's all very fluid. I'm told that the league wants these games to matter. They want these games to count, and they're dangling, say, a CONCACAF Champions League place as the prize at the end of all this, and it would replace the one that went to the U.S. Open Cup winner, because it's looking more and more likely like the U.S. Open Cup is not going to take place this year. There's just not enough time to get it in. So, but again, this is all very fluid. I mean, you have different situations where different shelter-in-place orders in different MLS cities, and so I think the league is really doing its best to try to come up with a situation that works. And by the time that this tournament is over, I think the hope is that in each MLS city, the situation will have calmed down to a degree that they can return to their cities and then maybe resume having games behind closed doors. But again, there are so many variables at play that it's making it really difficult for the league to plan.
As always, great stuff, Jeff. For more from Jeff, check out our website, ESPN.com. For more from Julie, check out her podcast, Laughter Permitted, available on the website. All right, that does it for this edition of ESPN FC. Thanks to everyone involved in the show, Gab, Jules, Ian, Craig, Julie, and Jeff. And to everyone, I hope you had a very happy Mother's Day and a happy and safe weekend as well. For now, it's time for Extra Time. Ian Dark and the one and only Shaka Hislop. Hey there, everybody. Welcome into a Sunday Mother's Day edition of Extra Time. We got Shaka Hislop, we got Ian Dark, and we have your questions, courtesy of the hashtag FCExtraTime. Let's get right to them. The first one comes from Jared. He asks, when the Bundesliga returns next weekend, do you think there will be more goals or no goals? Ian Dark, what do you think?
I think there'll be plenty of goals scored by Erling Haaland of Borussia Dortmund when it starts up again. I think the main point to make, I think it's a fantastic showcase, I think, for the Bundesliga, which sometimes struggles to sell its worldwide rights. It's going to have the show to itself.
Absolutely. All right, next question. I guess this is another one for, unless, Chaka, you've had any time in a commentary booth. You've had it as well, so you could answer this. Kartik wants to know, what was the most difficult name you had to pronounce during a commentary stint? Ian, you first.
I always struggle with South Korea. I dread covering them. I can never get the names into my head. But I think the most difficult one, apart from Socrates Papastathopoulos of Arsenal, who's thankfully been shortened to Socrates, there's a guy who played for Fulham called Kalinichich. See, and I don't think I've said it right there either. Struggle to say that in a fast in a penalty area. You know it's like, Seb.
Chaka.
All right, well, I don't have the experience that Ian has anyway with names from all over the world. I don't know. I've had my moments. There was a period over about 2 years that I couldn't get Fellaini's name right for the life of me. Don't ask me why. And there are a couple of others that are tricky, but I'm not in the booth as often as it used to be, or certainly as Ian ever was.
True, true. What's the one that Dan always struggles with, Shaka?
Çalhanoğlu. Always.
Çalhanoğlu.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think they put him in the highlights just to mess with Dan.
I'm sure we do. I'm sure they do.
Shaka, what did you fear most defending as a goalkeeper? Free kicks, corner kicks, or penalty?
Well, penalties, you're not expected to save a penalty. All the pressure's on the striker in that circumstance. So, I mean, as a goalkeeper, you don't fear them necessarily. In that regard, though, you kind of know, you can't almost have to inevitably expect that it's going to score, which is always a bitter pill to swallow. Corners, you defend those. You've got more than enough numbers in the box. Those aren't as threatening. But free kicks, certainly from a goalkeeping perspective, especially depending on who it is taking, is the biggest cause for headache. Because with good takers, they can go either side of the wall, and they can often leave you embarrassed. Whereas from the other two, I don't think, it has the same kind of pressure as a goalkeeper.
Guys, the Twitter accounts around this show continue to pick up steam. This one comes in from Dan the Orange Man. Ian, what were the worst conditions that you had to commentate a game in?
The worst conditions? Well, I covered the famous Snow Classico between the USA and Costa Rica, and I don't think US soccer are ever going to put on another March game in Denver. Because I've never seen a game completed with 4 inches of snow, but that was an incredible night. But the worst was much earlier in my career at Stoke one night. No, Port Vale, which is in Stoke, on the roof with no protection, with Andy Gray commentating. And it was like being on the deck of an Atlantic trawler. It was just lashing down the whole game. I think the microphones cut out 6 times during the commentary, and we went home absolutely drenched to the skin.
Brilliant, brilliant. Tom has the next question here. Why is it, okay. All right, Tom going in a little bit. All right, why has the Premier League historically failed to attract the world's superstar elite level players? Tom listed on Maradona, Ronaldo, 9, Brazilian Ronaldo, Messi, Neymar, Kaká, Batistuta, Pirlo, Figo, Ronaldinho, etc. Okay, we had CR7, but he was signed as a youngster. Is it just the weather or something else? Shaka, what do you think? Is weather keeping superstars out of the Premier League?
Well, I'm sure that's a factor, but Spain, Real Madrid and Barcelona in particular, have traditionally attracted the biggest names in world football. I'm sure the weather has something to do with it. Also, language has a lot to do with it as well. A lot of the names that you mentioned there are not native English speakers. But then, that's kind of a minority in terms of the cream of the crop. The Premier League continues to attract world-class talent. Maybe not along the likes of Ronaldo at his very best, or Lionel Messi, who, he went to Barcelona at, 14, something like that, and hasn't moved, understandably. That's not a fair indicator, I think, or fair accusation, I think, at all.
Ian, what do you think? Does the Premier League lack the elite-level star?
I think some of the superstars, I mean, Shaka's right, South American stars especially, tend to gravitate towards Spain mainly and sometimes Italy as well. And remember, it's only in more recent years that the Premier League's been maybe the biggest payers as well. The money used to be certainly in Italy, thinking of the early 90s. But I do think climate comes into it as well. I'll tell you a story here. We were out covering a Roma game in the Champions League, and Owen Hargreaves was the co-commentator with me, and he got to speak to Edin Dzeko, who played for Roma after the game, and said, Everton are interested in you, you know. And he said, what do you think I'm going to decide? I can stay in Rome or go to the pouring rain of Merseyside and play for Everton. Please don't ask me that one again.
Very well. All right, last one here. Question from Krucher. Good friend of the show. What's everyone's favorite soccer documentary to watch? Of course, plenty of options right now. He lists a few. Sunderland Till I Die, We Are LAFC, Boca Juniors Confidential. What would be a good new documentary in your opinion? Shaka, what are you watching?
I'm not watching any soccer documentaries, that's for sure. I certainly haven't seen any of those that were listed. I don't know. I mean, what stories would grab my attention? Maybe something around one of the bigger Premier League clubs right now and what's going on behind the scenes. But I'm always a little bit skeptical of those things. Having you know, spent time in many of those dressing rooms, a lot of what goes on, you know, won't be broadcast. And I know that. So I don't feel, personally speaking, I don't feel you're getting the full story. So they as a result, don't hold much interest for me.
Ian, any soccer docs in your queue?
Well, Tottenham have got one coming up, and of course they've been following the team around this season. It'll be interesting to see that when it comes out, bearing in mind what a surreal, bizarre season that it's turned out to be. I quite enjoyed the Sunderland one. I think Shaka's right. You know, the Manchester City one kind of had a feeling a bit like a PR exercise, and you get the feeling you're only seeing what they want you to see sometimes. But for me, Head and Shoulders, the best documentary, not only the best soccer documentary I've ever seen, is the 30 for 30, the two Escobars, about the Colombian team and Andres Escobar and his sad death, and how that was all intertwined with the drug story in Colombia. Absolutely phenomenal documentary. Anyone who hasn't seen that, see it.
Definitely. One of the best in a long line of best for 30 for 30. Can I throw one out there? Because this is one I just came across recently, and it's about American soccer. Soccer Town USA. It's about the group of guys in the early 90s from Kearney, New Jersey, that kind of led the U.S. back into the World Cup in Italy 90 and then 94 as well. It's all those guys from
Sounds
New Jersey.
Good.
Tab Ramos, Tony Miola, all those guys. Really interesting stuff. It's only about an hour and 20 minutes, so definitely worth a watch on YouTube. All right, I think that's it for this edition of Extra Time. Should we do one last final Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there? Show will be back tomorrow. Yeah. Dan Thomas is in the hot seat with his band of characters. Enjoy it.